America's intricate road network provides an ideal hunting ground for a bloodthirsty predator. He selects his victims from among hitchhikers wandering the roads. He kidnaps them, then tortures and rapes them. When his perverse needs are not yet satisfied, he kills his victims. February 5, 1990, on a highway in Houston, Texas, 18-year-old Nicole Tottle was desperately trying to get a motorist to stop. Someone finally stopped to help the young girl. She was injured and in shock. He drove her to the nearest phone to call the police. At the Houston police station, Nicole told officers that she had been kidnapped and raped, but that she had managed to escape. Her ordeal had begun in California a week earlier. On January 29th, at a truck stop, she had asked a trucker to take her with him. His name, he said, was Dusty, and he was heading east through Arizona. After a few hours, she fell asleep in the back of the truck. He seemed to be waiting for nothing more. He reached her and overpowered her. Before she was fully awake, he chained her to the sides of the truck and bayoneted her with a horse's neck. And then he whipped her and pierced her skin with needles and fish hooks before raping and sodomizing her. Nicole told police she was chained in the cab for 6 days. But the ordeal didn't end there. At the trucker's apartment in Houston, he allowed her to take a bath. Later, he chained her to the bed and raped her again. Helpless, she watched him approach her with a razor in his hand. He pressed the blade to her scalp and began to cut her hair. 3 hours later, he forced her into the truck. This time, he neglected to tie her up. He stopped at a brewery to pick up a load and left her alone for a few moments. Nick figured this might be her only chance to escape him. She got out of the truck, a leash tied to her neck. Near Houston, police pulled over a tractor trailer that matched the description Nicole had given. But when she saw the driver's face, she said it wasn't the man who had attacked her. A background check was conducted on the man. When nothing significant was found, he was released. Nicole asked the officers to stop the search. She was too scared to testify against the man who had attacked her. She just wanted to go home to California. On February 5th, the same day Nicole had gotten off the truck, another young woman was hitchhiking. About 15 miles from Pasadena, Texas, Regina and Walters, 14, were on the run with her new boyfriend. Since her parents' divorce, Regina had been living mostly with her father in Houston. She had been visiting her mother for a few days. That's when she decided to get away by hitchhiking. This young girl, who was trying to assert her independence, caught the attention of a trucker. He stopped to give her a lift into his truck.
Regina's mother, Caroline Walters, lived alone. She was a saleswoman in a department store. When she returned from work, she was surprised to find that her daughter was not at home. Regina had left no note, and everything indicated that she had not returned. She checked the answering machine but found no message. Carolyn then called her daughter's friends and her ex-husband in Houston. No one knew where Regina was. Distraught, the mother reported her missing to the Pasadena police. A detective met with her. She gave a description of her daughter. Regina was 14 years old. She was 5'10", weighed 90 pounds, and had long, curly brown hair. The detective asked Caroline what steps she had taken to find her daughter. She had posted her daughter's photo everywhere, but nothing had yet been found. Days earlier, she and her daughter had had an argument. At 9:30 that evening, Regina had told her she was going to visit a friend. Caroline objected, but her daughter assured her she would be back shortly. Reluctantly, Caroline agreed to let her out, but believing Regina would call her if she decided to come home later. Although the teenager had run away from home before, she had always returned home on her own after her escapades. But this time, Caroline had a feeling that something serious had happened to her. The case was assigned to Detective Suzanne Jackson of the Pasadena Police Department in Texas. She understood Caroline's concerns.
Several days had passed. Usually, when Regina was away, she would call her mother to reassure her. She would tell her that she would be home soon. But this time, that was not the case.
Caroline put up some posters at the grocery store near her house. She remained hopeful that her daughter was doing well and that nothing bad had happened to her. Maybe she was just at a friend's house after all. On the card she had posted everywhere, Caroline offered a reward for anyone who could provide information about her. Five days later, she received a phone call. The caller said that he had seen Regina talking to two young men the night she left the house. The names of these two young men were Billy and Ricky. The informant told her that Billy had a girlfriend with a very unusual name, Urana. Caroline immediately called the police. The next day, she received another call. The caller gave her the address of an apartment where he had seen Regina a few days earlier. The police went to the scene but did not get an answer.
Okay.
The building manager said that the apartment was rented by a certain Billy Wayne Gibbs. The next morning, Suzanne Jackson had a meeting with her colleagues about this case. She mentioned that she was looking for GIDs in connection with Regina's disappearance. She was also looking for two other people, a young woman named Urana and a certain Ricky. Unfortunately, she did not know their last names. To her surprise, some of her colleagues told her that he knew them. Billy Wayne Gibbs had a girlfriend named Yana Sweet, and one of his friends was Ricky Lee Jones. All three were wanted for a car theft. Police were dispatched to Gibbs' apartment to await his turn. Other officers monitored the roads in the area. After a few hours, they arrested Gibbs, 17, and his girlfriend Urana near Gibbs' apartment. They were handcuffed and taken to the station for questioning. The prime suspect, Ricky Lee Jones, was still at large. The arresting officer asked Gibbs if he had seen Regina or Ricky Lee Jones. Gibbs stated that he had spoken to them 4 days earlier but had not seen them since. He also told police that Regina and Ricky had fallen in love and were planning to go to Mexico, where Ricky's relatives lived. Ricky Lee Jones may have had another motive for leaving town. If he and Regina were arrested, they could be charged with enticing a minor into delinquency.
Regina was 14 years old, and they were clearly in love with each other. When they saw the posters Regina's mother posted offering a reward for her whereabouts, they probably thought it best to leave the area. That's when they decided to hitchhike to Mexico.
Rickley Jones was on parole for a robbery case. Leaving the jurisdiction of the authorities was a violation of his release conditions. The detective had an arrest warrant issued. She also entered Regina's description into the NCIC database, the National Crime Information Center. It contains the names of victims and perpetrators from all over the country. If any police department in the United States found Regina's car, the Pasadena police would be notified. Otherwise, it would be difficult to trace the loving couple who had no address or vehicle. About 15 miles away, Houston, police questioned Jerry Walters, Regina's divorced father. On the evening of March 17, he had received a disturbing call on his confidential phone line. The conversation had been brief, and Walters did not recognize the caller's voice. The man had asked him if he was Regina's father. Walters replied in the affirmative. The man then told him that he knew where his daughter was. She was in a barn. He added that he had changed her clothes and cut her hair. Regina's father then asked him to tell him if she was still alive, but the man hung up. Detective Jackson asked the phone company to trace the call. He was advised that it would take a few days. There was no choice but to wait. No other leads could be found to locate the girl and her boyfriend. In March 1990, Susan Jackson of the Pasadena, Texas police continued her search for Regina and Walters, 14. The girl had not been seen since early February when she left a friend's apartment with her boyfriend, Rickley Jones, 18. The detective's only clue was an anonymous phone call made to Regina's father on March 17. The call had not yet been traced. That same evening in Pasadena, the girl's mother also received a call. She recorded the conversation as police had advised. An unknown man arranged to meet her at the grocery store at 6:30 the next morning. He had something to tell her about Regina and wanted to do it in person. He hung up without giving his name or description. Caroline contacted Jackson. The latter warned her that she would be in danger if she went to the meeting alone. Since Caroline insisted, Susan Jackson decided to assign police officers to protect her. The police officers watched Caroline from a distance while she waited for the stranger at the grocery store. She could not identify the man in any way. He would have to introduce himself to her. She examined everyone who came and went, as well as the individuals who used the payphone. Carolyn waited more than 2 hours. But the person she called did not show up. 2 days later, the Pasadena Police Department received the requested information about the phone calls made to Regina's parents. The police learned that the one made to Jerry Walters in Houston came from a gas station in Ennis, Texas, 200 miles from where she had last been seen. As for the call to her mother's residence in Pasadena, it came from a payphone just a few blocks away.
At that point, we became very concerned about Regina. Both the phone calls and the information we'd received pointed to the very likely possibility that a crime had been committed.
The search continued in Texas until the fall of 1990 in Bandy, Illinois. A farmer was preparing to burn down his old abandoned barn. He hadn't been in it for a few years. He went up to the hayloft to do a final check. All he found were items he had long since gotten rid of. Nothing seemed unusual or out of place. Then something caught his attention. He looked more closely at the hay that had been scattered around and saw what appeared to be a human skeleton. He immediately called the police. Officer Mike Chilli of the Illinois State Police went to the scene.
I had received a call from the Bond County Sheriff's Office. They informed me that they had found a body in a rural area near Highway 70, a major highway that runs right through Bunnyal.
Forensics conducted a thorough search of the barn. They found no clothing. There was also no identification. They did, however, collect a piece of white wire that appeared to have been there recently. The police photographed the scene from various angles. They then found wire used to tie hay bales. It was identical to a piece of wire wrapped around the victim's neck. There were still some hairs on the head. It was small, suggesting that the victim was probably a child. There had been no murders in the Greenville area for 10 years. The mystery surrounding this crime was particularly disturbing. It was not possible to determine whether the victim was a local or had been abandoned by someone who had driven down Interstate 70. At first glance, the age or sex of the victim could not be determined. A forensic anthropologist examined the remains. The information he obtained was very useful to State Police Officer Mike Chilli.
He was able to determine that the victim was a 14 to 16-year-old girl, and that her weight was approximately 90 to 110 pounds. Her hair had been cut. It had started to grow back, but the forensic examiner said it was recent.
The cause of death was strangulation. The killer had practically severed the victim's head by wrapping wire around her neck 16 times. Based on the condition of the joints and vertebrae, the murder occurred a year ago. A chemist analyzed a piece of white thread found near the body. It might give some clues as to what clothing the girl or her killer was wearing. The fiber was mostly cotton and likely came from a towel, not clothing. State Police Officer Mike Chilli entered the victim's description into the NCIC database. This unidentified young woman of white ethnicity and estimated to be between 14 and 16 years old was likely killed in September 1989.
The sheer number of files, 950, that matched her age, weight, and the approximate date of her death clearly indicated that the identification process would be a challenging one, a challenging one.
Chilli narrowed his search by limiting the victim's time of death to the spring of 1990. He obtained about 100 records. He relayed his information to police departments that worked on such cases. Susan Jackson, who was investigating the disappearance of Regina Walters in Pasadena, Texas, received this message on October 16. Since the description matched Regina's, she called the sheriff in B. The operator told her that they had received so many calls about this that the sheriff would call her back later. But before hanging up, Susan Jackson remembered the mysterious call Regina's father had received. The man on the other end of the line had told her that the girl was in a barn.
When I asked her if the body had been found in a barn, the operator immediately transferred my call to the sheriff. We immediately had a feeling that it was Regina, and we exchanged information by teletype.
Jackson then asked the sheriff another question based on the March 17 call to the original father. The girl found in the barn had chosen to have shaved her hair. She was told that she had. Additionally, the girl's description matched Regan's in every way.
We sent a copy of the dental x-rays to the sheriff's office where they compared them with the victim's teeth. They confirmed that it was Regina.
But one question remained unanswered. Where was Ricky Lee Jones, the victim's boyfriend? Investigators requested the FBI's assistance. Special Agent Mark Young, a behavioral scientist from the Houston office, was assigned to the investigation.
I went there and tried to meet with anyone who might have been in contact with Ricky or Regina. I thought she might mention something that would help us track Ricky down.
At the high school he attended, Pasadena detectives were also continuing their search for Ricky Lee Jones. A school counselor informed them that Jones had not enrolled in school the previous year. She had little information about him, but she was able to give them his last known address. It was at his parents' house. There, detectives met his sister, Tammy. No one in the family had seen Ricky in over a year. His parents disapproved of his bad company. They were convinced he would end up in prison. Investigators then asked if they had any relatives in Mexico. Tammy assured them that they did. Members of her mother's family lived in Matamoros, just south of the Texas border. Jackson showed him a photo of Regina, but Tammy didn't recognize her.
Because Ricky hadn't followed the conditions of his parole release, the police were already looking for him. We thought he was afraid to come home because he knew something about Regina's disappearance and death.
By carefully analyzing the case file, Special Agent Mark Young developed a profile of the killer. He deduced that Ricky Lee Jones probably hadn't committed the crime.
If Ricky Lee Jones had killed Regina, he would have done so in a fit of rage, and that would have been reflected in the crime scene. On the contrary, the scene had been very carefully planned. The perpetrator had a plan. It seemed to us that he was an older person, a white male, a traveler, like a truck driver or a salesman.
Someone who had a motive for being in the area. The fact that the barn was near the highway supported Agent Yang's hypothesis. The crime scene gave him more information about the killer. He was a sadist. He had torn off Regina's clothes, slowly strangled her until she stopped breathing, and surprisingly, shaved off her hair.
Whoever had committed this crime had gone to great lengths. He was likely a sex offender or a sadist. Someone who had committed other crimes in the past.
Investigators then learned of another crime in the town of Marshall, Texas, 200 miles north of Houston. The partial skeletal remains of a young man had just been discovered on the bank of a small stream. The left side of his skull had been punctured by a small caliber weapon. Although there were few identifying clues, the victim's age and the location where he was found suggested that he might have been Ricky Lee Jones.
There were no more leads, so we called it quits. There was nothing more we could do.
To investigators, it seemed as though the man who had killed RCK, Walters, and her boyfriend had gotten away with it. The search for a sadist killer was temporarily suspended in Pasadena, Texas. About 1,000 miles away in Arizona, authorities were faced with another problem. An Arizona Highway Patrol trooper was finishing up his shift when he spotted a truck parked on the shoulder of an on-ramp. The vehicle had to be moved because it was posing a hazard to motorists. He noticed that the headlights were on and the engine was still running. As he approached the left door, Officer Michael Miller saw a man suddenly emerge from the cab and extend his arms along the side of the truck.
I asked him what was going on. He replied, "Nothing, officer. Are you okay? I have a gun in my back pocket." He then made a movement toward his back pocket before placing his hands on the truck again. This was rather unusual. I could hear a woman screaming inside the truck.
Miller handed him the goggles and had him sit in the back seat of his car for questioning.
He assured me that everything was fine. The woman with him was consenting. I didn't know if she was screaming simply because I had startled her or surprised her, and I was determined to get to the bottom of this.
Once Rods was seated, his hands cuffed behind his back, Miller secured him with the seatbelt. He returned to the truck to check on the woman. Her handles and ankles had been cuffed to the sides of the truck. The patrolman assured him that she was no longer at risk.
I told him that she would have to stay there until I could get help. It was obvious that this was a crime scene and that forensics would be coming to analyze her. I told him to stay calm. I then got out of the truck and went back to my car.
Miller returned just in time. Despite the monotones, Rads had managed to get his hands in front of him and unbuckle his seatbelt. He was about to open the door. The officer handcuffed her again.
Routine checks are rarely done on this road, so you never know who you're dealing with. It makes my blood run cold to think that this cruel man could have killed me and the girl and continued to drive around with impunity.
The Casa Grande Police Department dispatched officers to the scene. They freed the woman from her restraints and took her and Rads to the police station for questioning. Inside the truck, the forensics team found an arsenal of torture devices. Chains that could be attached to rings welded to the back of the compartment, fish hooks, bloodstained towels, a dead man on horseback, and a suitcase filled with torture devices. The suitcase also contained a camera and a handful of hair that did not belong to the victim. Detective Rick Barnhart of the Casa Grande Police Department was leading the investigation.
Robert Rads had a rape kit of sorts in his truck. He had a variety of paraphernalia, including long poles with staples attached that he used to pull and quarter his victims. He also had whips. This convinced me that Rads was a predator.
The woman chained up in Rhodes' truck was Kathy Ann Vine. She was 27 years old. She told investigators that Rose had taken her into his truck about an hour earlier at Rip Griffin's truck stop north of Phoenix. She had fallen asleep in the back compartment. That's where the trucker assaulted her and then chained her to the sides of the truck. He told her that his name was Whips and Chains and that he had been doing this type of thing for 15 years. Police photographed her injuries. She had burn marks on her wrists from the monocles, and she was covered in bruises. She had tried to resist her attacker, but her hands were chained. All she could do to defend herself was to bite him. She had injured her left shoulder enough to prevent him from raping her. Kathleen agreed to file charges of assault and kidnapping, but Detective Bernhardt could see that he would have difficulty getting her to testify against W.S.
My interview with Kathleen was rather bizarre. She talked about this event, this terrible attack she had suffered. Then from time to time, she told me about the trip she had taken across the country to meet the president. She wanted to give him a microchip. She also told me about a secret prison from which no one could escape. The more she talked, the more discouraged I became, because I needed Kathleen's articulate testimony about this horrible misadventure.
The investigator asked Robert Ben Rods to give his version of events. Brad stated that Kathleen was a crazy ally. He added that she was one of those women who bartered sexual favors to travel on trucks. She was the one who had solicited him. She liked to have rough sex, although in fact he had not had formal sexual relations. He refused to talk about what had happened in the compartment. He remained evasive, without ever suggesting that there had been any crime there. The police photographed R's wound on his shoulder. It looked like a bite, as Kathleen had indicated. RS stated that he had inflicted it while loading his truck. Inspector Bart was more inclined to believe Kathleen's version.
She told me that she had tried to bite him in the throat, but when he moved, she had bitten him instead on the top of his left shoulder. The photo corroborated her version.
Prosecutors arrested Rads and charged him with assault, rape, and false imprisonment. Unfortunately, the prosecution's only witness, Kathleen Vine, was a paranoid psychotic. To keep the suspect behind bars, they had to find other witnesses. Bart was haunted by Kathleen's statements. Rods had confided to him that he'd been kidnapping women for 15 years. He entered his name into the NCIC in case other police departments reported similar crimes. As the investigator continued his research, numerous newspapers in the Southwest reported on the case. A Houston police officer read an article about it. The suspect detained in Arizona matched the description of an individual intercepted in the Houston area earlier that year. The officer suspected Rads of kidnapping a woman in his truck and raping and torturing her for 6 days. 6 days until she managed to escape. At that time, no charges could be filed because the victim was unable to identify her assailant. Sergeant Bomar of the Houston Police Department spoke to Detective Barnhart about it.
Sergeant Bomar called me to tell me about the case of a young woman who had managed to escape. I was convinced that Robert Rods was a repeat rapist. I also believed that he might be a murderer.
Since Rods had traveled several states since his last crime, Detective Barnhart asked the FBI for help. He hoped that with the support of this federal agency, he could gather enough evidence to charge him with his multiple sexual assaults. For Special Agent Bob Lee of the Houston office, the investigation would begin with a visit to Rods' apartment in Houston. He interviewed the owner of the building. She had entered the apartment after the suspect's arrest and had been horrified to find bloodstained instruments of torture. Based on this statement, Officer Rods obtained a search warrant.
Serial rapists often keep trophies of their victims, an item of clothing, jewelry, or other object. In his apartment, we found an assortment of items for tying up and confining people, including chains and handcuffs. There was also a bar fixed to the wall to which he could tie a person. We also discovered a lot of women's jewelry.
The police officers collected white towels stained with blood, women's clothing, and numerous photographs showing a number of women with shaved hair, nude or partially nude, bound and covered in bruises. Presumably, Rods took these photographs to remind himself of his crimes and to relive the excitement of terrorizing his victims. The police had good reason to believe that Rods was a repeat rapist, but he could not identify his victims from the photographs. Without witnesses, the chances of convicting him were slim. Kathleen Vine's testimony was questionable. It would be her word against the suspects. But the fact that she suffered from mental illness would certainly have a negative impact on the jury's decision. In December 1990, Arizona prosecutors decided to cut a deal with Rads, a 6-year sentence that included incarceration and parole if he pleaded guilty to the charges filed by Kathleen Vine. Her attorney agreed. This meant that Rods could be paroled after about a year and resume searching for new victims. In In October 1991, a year after Reginak and Walters, 14, were found murdered in Illinois, the investigation remained unsolved. FBI psychologist, special agent Mark Young believed it was possible that the killer was a truck driver or a salesman with a history of sexual offenses.
One day, Bob Lee, an FBI agent with the Violent Crime Squad, overheard me talking to another officer on the phone and said,
quote,
"One of the cases I worked on a few months ago involved a trucker who had kidnapped a young girl and cut her hair."
The victim's name was Nicole Tuttle. Like Regina and Walters, she had been repeatedly raped. Furthermore, she had run away the same day that Regina K. Walters and Ricky Lee Jones were last seen alive, which was Monday, February 5th, 1990. On that same date, Houston police officers had intercepted Robert Ben Rolls, a trucker whose description matched the one Nicole had given of her attacker. Unfortunately, she had been unable to identify him. Special Agent Lee of the FBI's Houston office, however, recalled that Nicole had later changed her story while in the hospital where she was being treated for her injuries.
Later that evening, she told investigators that Robert Ben Rolls was indeed the individual who had kidnapped her. When asked if she wanted to press charges, she told the officer that she simply wanted to go home.
Bob Lee added that Nicole was not the trucker's only victim. Rolls was incarcerated in an Arizona prison for the assault of Kathleen Vine. He would be eligible for parole in 3 months. The officer then described to her what they had found at Rad's home during the search.
They found photographs. In one of them, they could see another young woman with cropped hair. This photograph appeared to have been taken in a barn.
The victim was wearing women's clothing. She was wearing a black dress and appeared to be fleeing Rad's camera into a barn.
When I saw these photographs, I was certain that this was original Walters. To confirm this, I met with her family and obtained numerous photographs of her. Some of the features and markings on her face matched Rhodes' photos perfectly.
FBI agents began building a case to charge Rolls with kidnapping and murder. They examined the items seized from her apartment one by one. They discovered additional photographs of Regina and women's clothing, including a black dress. A lab examination confirmed that this was the dress Regina was wearing in the photos. Agent Mike Chill of the Illinois State Police was notified. Chill sent the evidence collected at the Greenville barn to the FBI lab in Houston. The cotton fiber found at the crime scene was identical to that on the bloodstained towels found at Rhodes' home. Nothing could be concluded from this, however, since these types of towels are found almost everywhere. Detective Suzanne Jackson of Pasadena met with agents Chile and Young Ai at their office in Houston. The purpose of this meeting was to gather all the evidence needed to charge Rolls, not only with Regina's murder, but also with the crimes committed against his other victims. Rolls was due to be released shortly. Officer Mike Chill of the Illinois State Police knew that they had to act quickly. He was eligible for parole and would be allowed to work outside the prison walls. This was almost a full release. They wanted to charge him while he was still behind bars. The officers questioned Mike Young, Rad Houston's former employer. Rad Houston wasn't surprised to see law enforcement officers arrive since the local police department had encountered him before. A few years earlier, Rolls had been suspected of sexually assaulting a woman in the back of his truck. No formal charges had been filed, however. The truck he was driving at the time had since been sold. Hegelton provided them with the suspect's vehicle identification number, his logbooks, and his gas receipts. While the agents followed up on this lead, the rest of the team was busy piecing together his every move. Gas receipts from a gas station in Ennis, Texas were dated March 17, 1990. That was the exact date and location of the call to Jerry Walters, Regina's father. Several of the calls to Caroline, the victim's mother, also coincided with Rod's time in Houston. But one question remained unanswered. The killer had been able to obtain Corrine's number from the posters she had put up everywhere, but how had he obtained Jerry Walters' unlisted number? The agent found the answer among the evidence stored in Arizona.
We got our hands on Regina's phone book. The cover page contained mostly personal information, including his mother's address and phone number, as well as his father's.
As he flipped through the notebook, Young was disturbed by a message he believed to have been written by Rods himself. Above the sentence, "Ricky is a dead man," a knife and a gun were drawn. The letters appeared to be dripping with blood. Only a DNA test could confirm the identity of the young man whose remains had been found in Southeast Texas. Unfortunately, investigators did not have Jones' DNA to compare. Since Rods had claimed to have been abducting and torturing victims for 15 years, police entered the information into the FBI's database, which contains information on thousands of solved and unsolved crimes in the United States. Despite the lack of information and the gaps in reconstructing Rhodes' movements, Suzanne Jackson obtained about 50 unsolved homicide and missing persons cases. She wasn't caught driving.
From Houston to Los Angeles in a 4 or 5 day period, so one can imagine the number of people he encountered and the number of secluded places where he could assault his victims and dispose of their bodies.
A week later, police tracked Rod's truck to Houston. It had been 2 years since he had used it. Although the cab had been steam cleaned, repainted, and used by other drivers, traces of the crimes were still there. Investigators found a hair that matched Regina's. Miraculously, they also discovered her fingerprint on the upholstery in the back compartment. This was definitive proof that she had been in the truck. Unfortunately, it didn't indicate when or whether she had been there against her will. In January 1992, FBI agents had to face the facts. The evidence they had did not provide evidence that the suspect had been involved in more than one state. They dropped the investigation under federal law. Since Rhodes' parole hearing was due a week later, the agents convinced the B County prosecutor to file a charge of voluntary manslaughter. The evidence was circumstantial, but it would delay his release. I feared losing track of him due to overcrowding in the prisons. I was confident he would be released. On February 6, investigators went to the Arizona State Prison in Florence to execute the warrant for Rad's arrest. Their goal was to confront him with the photographs of Regina in the hopes of extracting a confession from him. An incriminating statement from Rods would only add weight to the case. The suspect remained unmoved. He even had a smug look on his face.
We spent about an hour with Rad, but he was unwilling to talk. He denied any involvement in the case. He stood firm. That meant we would have to prove his guilt.
The police suspected that Rads felt they had little evidence to frame him. Almost 2 years after Regina and Walters were killed, and at least two other women were kidnapped and sexually assaulted, Robert Ben Rods was extradited from Arizona to stand trial in Illinois. His attorney had the trial postponed for 6 months. On September 11th, the arrogant trucker finally lost his nerve. In B County Court in Illinois, his attorney pleaded his innocence to the capital murder charge. If convicted, he faced the death penalty. He accepted the plea deal, which was to plead guilty to first-degree murder, which carried a possible life sentence. Rods was ultimately sentenced to life in prison without parole. Although he is serving his sentence in a maximum security prison in Chester, Illinois, investigators have not yet closed the case. They continue to gather evidence, as they are determined to prove that Regina K. Walters was not Rad's only victim.
We also have a photo of a woman who once boarded his truck. She has not yet been identified. We fear she may be another of his victims. Anyone who enters the home of a serial killer risks becoming his prey.
Investigators are still working to identify the women photographed by RS. They hope this will bring some comfort to the grieving relatives of his victims.